usually I come into this with food in my mouth. Somehow I managed to finish everything before
I gave you enough time.
I introduced the food in the mouth section. Session.
Apparently not. Episode, no.
Well, this is the beer in the head session is what it is.
Yeah. We will be following this up with a beautiful lunch of sustenance.
Lunch. Yes. So one of the, you know, just to wrap things up with this Casa Pacifica thing, here we're on the meltdown portion of the best of show.
Hashtag CP best and best.
There you go. Very good. And you were just ready to do that.
It's like a loaded gun ready to pull the trigger.
And so leading back to a conversation that we were having about how when we got to the best of show, there's three beers sitting in front of four judges, you, Zach, Kevin, and Andrew. And it was just fun listening to the conversations.
It was a little bit of banter.
Yeah, there was some banter. And what was more fun was the, I don't know if you could feel it, but there was a certain amount of excitement in the room other than you because we knew the beers that were there.
Yeah.
And there was definitely, among the people who were in that beer, there was certainly a favorite that they were rooting for. And to watch all three of you, or four of you, come to the same conclusion that the rest of the people were.
And it was pretty quick. I mean, you put the three beers down in front of us. They are all distinct. There was definitely, especially among, like when you put the beers side by side, two of them were a little lighter and golden, mm-hmm. and one was brown.
Right.
So right there, it was, you know, we knew kind of which direction we were going to go based on it, what everybody would had rated and were tasting throughout the course of the judging. It didn't take long for us to slide the two light beers to the side and go, let's really get into the heart of this amber, this maple brown,
right,
and understand the thought process. Mm-hmm. What's everybody tasting? Why are we immediately sliding this session IPA and double IPA to the side?
What I found fascinating about it is that this, although the food pairings were an important part of the judging, I did not give you the focus of trying to pick a beer that would go with food, but true to the beer styles, and it's a beer that's made aged on maple wood. And so there's no maple syrup in it. There's a slight woodiness to it, but but the way that the judges, all of you, went towards one, a medium sessionable beer instead of a big heavy double IPA or this light session IPA, sure, finding one that was in between. And one would think that, you know, and true to best of show, it's which one of these beers are you going to want to drink more than one of?
And I think
and the double IPA is really too heavy, and the session IPA may have been too hoppy harsh for some people.
And I think it really speaks to the trends and the general marketplace right now in general, that although you don't necessarily always pick your beer based on the food you want to eat with it, it is a more common place to put beer and food together. Mm-hmm. You know, you want something that you can sit down, and there are a lot of beers that you and I enjoy, especially in the IPA variations, that mm-hmm. you just want a good beer and you want it to be dry and piney or hoppy or whatever. But more often than not, I think people gravitate towards a beer that they can put with food without even thinking about it. Like, do I want to sit and have two or three of these with my meal and just relax and enjoy my evening or my day, mm-hmm. versus drinking for the sake of drinking? And just like wine and spirits for that matter, you know, there's a trend where people want them partnered. You know, having a more cohesive and encompassing experience versus just sitting down for a drink to drink, I think is kind of the direction that people are going.
And it was interesting to see how that went, you know, and I was having a conversation earlier with one of the people who was helping out, talking about how sometimes standing out against the crowd that works for you. And certainly in many best of shows, so when you have a brew competition that has hundreds of entrants, they each table of four or five judges might be tasting four or five of those beers, and then they all move on. So then you have, at some point, a beer from each one of those tables, which might all be IPAs, coming together. Right. And so then you're tasting five IPAs together. Well, which one of those ones stands out? So being the envelope pusher on that can really help get you into the best of show. Well, that wasn't what was happening with these ones, because there weren't two beers. I don't even think there were two IPAs. There wasn't a single doubled up on these. So,
and that was actually kind of nice, especially for me, just being selfish. It was my first judging experience in a beer competition. I've judged some food in the past, but I was kind of anxious. I was nervous about being tainted, almost, of having, you know, a couple beers that may be similar in style, and having a discernible enough perspective on those beers to, like you said, separate them. Right. If I had two IPAs or three IPAs next to each other, looking at the Brewer Association's guidelines, would I be able to find enough variance between them to make a judgment? Mm-hmm. And thankfully, for my first experience, they were all seven rounds were a different style.
Right. Well, and so then when it came to, so I was telling this person that now, you know, these people are all, they're all professional enough, you know, in that they're going to not let that envelope pusher kind of, if you had four beers sitting in front of you, are you going to pick the one that's way out of, or pushing the envelopes out of its category, or are you going to pick one that's closer to it? And so it just happened to be, though, that in the best of show, there was this session IPA, a double IPA, and then you have this brown that's sitting right in the middle. And because of its color and its session ability, that's what set it apart. It wasn't that it was pushing the envelopes.
It was like, it was true to style.
Like each one of these, like the other two were doing, this one stayed right there. And this is, and I don't think we've referenced the name yet. It's Institution Ale Company.
You're gonna release the cat.
Well, Institution Ale Company's, it's their restraint ale. And so it's an American brown, so it's a little hoppier, a little crisper, a little cleaner, and it's aged on maplewood. But it was truly the best in the fest on that. Even coming out of the first round, it had the highest point total. So out of the first round, it still had the highest point total. That doesn't mean that when you go to the best of show that it's going to be picked out of those three beers.
No, and again, that first round was strictly against its own style, its own category. Mm-hmm. And so like you just referenced and alluded to, it could have had the most points in the first round against its own style, but as a total experience and a cohesive drink, mm-hmm. may have come in second or third. But it didn't. It stayed, cream rose to the top.
Well, one of the things that I found really, one of the topics that from that Best of Fest, or where all of you were sitting around, the Best of Show conversation was a topic that came up of blending. And so talking about blending the Easy Jack with the King Tide, the double IPA.
I think where your grin is coming from is that it was a pretty intense conversation of nuances and discrepancies, I think sounds harsh, but there was perspective from two judges that each beer had some deficiencies in their eyes in terms of style. Mm-hmm. And as the deficiencies were identified and there was kind of some banter back and forth about what each person was picking out of the beer, there was this kind of underlying conclusion that they would benefit, the two beers would benefit from being brought together. Right. In a single glass.
Yep. And so that's what we're doing here this afternoon. And blending is a centuries-old technique of, and seriously, when I'm not just like pulling your chain when I say centuries, I'm talking it's more than 200 years old, so it is more than centuries. But of blending beers, and whether you're blending sour beers with old beers that have been sour, you know, just gone sour because that there's microbiology in their wooden casks, and blending it with fresh beer, or if you're talking about what we've just done here today, is taking a double IPA. I filled up our taster glass about half full with Easy Jack, and I put about a quarter, a third or so of it with the Big Island, the King Tide Double IPA. I've done this before with several other beers, and one of my favorite beers to do this with, when Bigfoot Barley Wine was too much for me, is I would mix the Bigfoot Barley Wine with the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
Really?
And it makes a fantastic double IPA.
I would not guess those two.
When you mix those two together. And so here we're bringing down the body of that King Tide with the Easy Jack, and we're mellowing out some of the hop harshness that may be perceived by some people with the Easy Jack, because the Easy Jack is a one-sided hop forward beer.
Even though it's designated as a session, which I think in some people's minds means a soft, easy, low alcohol drink, there is a discernible hop presence. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no mistaking its roots as an IPA.
Right. So the whole idea for this meltdown was just to introduce maybe this activity to people who haven't thought of it yet, is if you have a beer that is too one-sided one way, so if it's too hoppy, if it's too viscous, if it's too anything, finding a beer that can balance that out, and even just starting with as easy as a 50-50 pour, which is what I did with the Bigfoot Barley Wine in the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, is do a 50-50 pour. You get two beers worth, but by mixing a 12% barley wine with a 6% pale ale, you're getting three beers worth the alcohol out of two beers. I mean, you're really pushing your mileage on this thing.
Well,
your mileage may vary, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
But as a home brewer, it's something that, behind me with my taps, that I've played around with blending a lot, and even having homebrew parties where I say, okay, you've gone through the list, now I try tap 3 with tap 4, give those to a 50-50 mix and see what kind of new beer you come up with.
Right.
Well, and I certainly didn't invent that concept.
I think it's a technique too that, especially for modern production breweries, speaks to efficiency and consistency. When you're looking at volume brewing, grains change based on growing seasons and conditions and environment, and your efficiency on a beer is going to change. Ideally, you are really shooting from a scientific standpoint for a minor threshold between batches. You want that beer to be the same each time you brew it, but sometimes there can variables that you can't control. And for consumers' benefit, you may need to tweak and play with those beers that you've produced. If you have 20,000 gallons of a beer and it's just not quite right based on the last batch, but you realize through some blending and some critique that if you added in a little bit of a saison for some crispness and fruitiness, and it brings it back in line with what people know in the bottle, that's going to save 20,000 gallons of brew. Yep. I don't mean to, really allude to the fact that breweries are trying to deceive consumers, but there's a strong financial investment as well, and blending is just a way to, again, keep the consistency of flavor and expectation in line so that you can still continue to produce the beer that the consumers are asking for and in a financially responsible way.
Well, and this is something that's been happening in Belgium forever. I mean, when you look at some of the lambics that you just love, the Duchesse de Bourgogne or any of the Cantillons or any of that, they have a master blender, just like scotches do, whiskey, these companies have these, so that they can taste it from one year to the next. Because when you buy a bottle of the Duchess, you want it to taste like the last bottle of Duchess.
And some,
these are two beers that have been aging, one of those beers may be 3 years old. It can't be
very similar to blended scotches and whiskeys, and in the brewery world, like some styles rely on the blending, like a Goes. That's a 3-year blend.
Right.
The core ramifications of that style dictate that I take third year, second year, and first year age and mix them to the best product possible.
Right. So it's a fun way to experiment with beer. I'm curious about your take on this one here. My personal preference is that maybe I would, after I went light and dark, that maybe I would go the other way. And part of the light to dark
you
is...
You mean skewing the percentage?
Is part of, yeah, the light to dark is my art background coming together, that you start with the lightest, when you're mixing colors, you start with the light color and then you add just a little bit of the dark color.
Sure.
Because it takes a lot less. So that's why I started with this one. I think maybe I would go the other way, is go 3/4 or 2/3 of the double IPA and then a third of the Easy Jack.
I agree with you prominently, because I think the hop presence and that residual bitterness is still pretty intense. Mm-hmm. Even though you've blended them, it's a pretty dry, resiny, hoppy beer.
Right.
And if you'd have gone with the double IPA as your base, you'd have retained a little more of the malty sweet mm-hmm. backbone, and you'd be able to slowly and incrementally refine it back up to a balanced IPA. I mean, really, that's what we're looking at doing. When you take the session IPA and a double IPA, you're trying to get back to the middle, just like a very effective and clever politician. You want to start with two extremes and bring yourself back to the base. Right. And an IPA for both the session and for the double is its roots.
Right.
So I think you're spot on there, where maybe going with a double IPA as your foundation and slowly adding in the session would have gotten you to a more approachable hop presence.
Well, and this is something that we're familiar with, especially with Firestone Walker being in our backyard virtually, that when they do their blending projects for their anniversary beers and everything else, we're aware of it, you know, through Facebook, whatever else, and certainly people across the world are aware of it too if they're following Firestone Walker, if they know about it. But this is on the wine side. You've been involved with these blending projects where you take 10% of this and 2% of this and 1% of this. That's kind of the same thing. You know, I mean, we're just doing it in these little
sure.
ones, these little tasters. But we could easily get out a graduated cylinder and pour in 35 centiliters of this and 10 centiliters of that, and build this beer based on...
And the reason for the graduated cylinder is really, I mean, when we're looking at a commercial production level, mm-hmm. so that you have the right proportions. Right. You can scale this thing.
Sure.
We're just tossing it in a glass to right. see how it tastes. But if you want to get exact and precise, like you're mentioning, a graduated cylinder is to delineate those percentages. And you made the reference to wineries. When we talk about blending in a winery, it doesn't always have to be the exact same percentage from vintage to vintage. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even have to be the exact flavor and aroma that you had the year before. It has to elicit the feeling. It has to elicit the taste and the memory of that bottle. So when you look at the label and you say X style from 2013 versus X style 2014 from the same winery or earlier, you may be like, oh, well, it's a little jammier, or it's a little spicier, or it's a little earthier. But if, as long as it brings to the forefront your feeling and the reminiscent characters of the year before, then that's the goal.
Right.
You know, the percentages may be a little different, and they may even add a whole new variety to help balance it out, or to give it a little sweeter finish, or a little spicier aroma.
Mm-hmm.
But the consistency is, what does it make you feel, and how do you taste it compared to the last vintage? The same, I think, holds true with beer.
Well, and I agree with you that breweries do that same kind of thing with their special releases, and whether it's their anniversary releases or if it's, you know, Sukaba or Parabola from Firestone Walker, that's just because they're so close to us that I can keep referencing them, that they, you know, that each year... You know, you're gonna get people who are gonna nitpick this and go, nah, you know, last year's version was so much better than this year's.
I love when you pull out the braces, beer geek.
And it's like the percentages were there, and I don't care. Does it taste good? That's what I want. And I think, but you know, wineries, on the other hand, they get to do that every year because it's such. But if
that's expected, that's what
right. If I pick up a bottle of Easy Jack, for instance, this year, I want it to taste the same exact beer next year. Although, I think breweries do a really good job of blending it to make sure that they... And like, just to reference another podcast that we're on, Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, when we were interviewing Jamil, and he's talking about he knows his beers. Those raw ingredients change, but he tastes it to make sure that when it goes in the bottle, it tastes the same. And sure. So they're tweaking these things all the time.
Whoop. And that...
There it is.
That right there just sums
it
up.
I think it's a good enough time to call it quits, don't you?
We have beaten that horse. but I think a takeaway is that if you have a couple of beers in your fridge, you picked them up on a friend's recommendation, and they're not quite to your liking, right. But you see some positive characteristics of each, have a little fun. Pour it in the glass. What do you got to lose?
Yeah.
Mix them up.
And I
don't shake it, though. It's not a cocktail.
No, this is not a shaken, not stirred kind of thing. One suggestion I would make, you know, we've got nearly a full growler of a 9.9%.
Good thing you got a cooler about
double
you.
IPA. Yeah, so and we haven't taken much out of it, so it's not going to lose a lot of carbonation, and you know, I'll tighten this down. But one of the things that I do with a growler, say if I've had half of it, intending to drink the whole thing, because I understand a growler is a commitment. And this is a short-term commitment.
One of the few commitments in your life.
Right. Curtis. But when I open it, I know that I have to drink this thing. Is making sure that you have some nice... One of the things you should make sure that you have is some nice pale ales on some nice neutral pale ales. And so, like, especially for an IPA, if this thing goes flat, I can always pour in half a glass and then come find it a nice pale ale. Pour it in, it's going to give it the carbonation it needs, and you don't have to dump the thing down the sink. I mean, because
That's a tip I'd not been aware of up until now.
9.9% growler was probably, I mean, I'm guessing that they're charging a pretty hefty amount of money for that growler, and you don't want to throw down $10 worth of beer, you know, throw away $10 worth of beer, especially if you can salvage it with, you know, if this beer is still 2 or 3 days old. Salvage it with, say, an Easy Jack by pouring some of it in, pouring some fresh beer into it, and to blend it to give it the carbonation.
Pale to the double IPA, using this specific example, is close enough that you're not going to kill the nuances of each.
Yeah.
You're not going to. It's not like you're taking a stout and mixing in a Saison hoping to grab carbonation. I mean, these are similar styles where you're going to get flavor profiles that complement each other.
Now, if you wanted to, say, mix a stout with a Flanders Red, I think maybe you might have something going there.
Future show.
There it is, right there.
That is a tip from your hashtag beer suggestioneer.
Beer suggestioneers. That was my hashtag mark right there. Listen closely for the click in the audio. Feel free to rewind to listen back for it. It seems like it's melting down pretty good.
Weird.
It was kind of serious up until about 4 seconds ago, and then all of a sudden it just seemed to...
It's not a typical meltdown, but it had some fun content nonetheless.
Continent?
Yeah, it's a fun continent. As long as there's no incontinence, we'll be good. Remember, follow all our conversations at hashtag pints and pairings, hashtag beer suggestioneers. We got a Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/pintsandpairings. Give us a like. Give us your feedback. And...
Field pairings.
Oh, forgot about that.
Let's do field pairings.
How dare I forget about the hashtag field pairing?
Use hashtag field pairings, and that'll help. That'll tag us with it. Whenever you're out having a burger and a beer, or if you have a pizza and a beer, or say you found a nice blue cheese grilled asparagus and you were pairing it with a session IPA.
Ooh, your excitement just went up.
All of that together in one frame, tag us with it.
That's the key, my friend. Let us not lose the sight of... The beer must be in the frame. Otherwise, it's not a field pairing. It's just food.
Otherwise, we're going to haze you. If you post just a picture of food and then another picture of the beer, that's not going to work for us.
No, that's two independent pictures, not a hashtag field pairing.
That is not. So do all that stuff for us, like we just said.
We love your feedback.
That's true. All right, so you know, as always, I want to remind everyone listening, whether you're watching, enjoying us on your earbuds, or on the speakers in your car, I guess. I suppose that could happen.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. To eat, drink, and be happy.
We'll see you the next pour.
Cheers.